Something interesting is happening right now in the war in Ukraine. As the conflict has continued dragging on, more and more weapons and equipment have begun entering into the Russian army's hands from outside countries like Iran, North Korea, and even China. Since the invasion began, Iran has been known to have provided more than 3,700 explosive kamikaze drones they manufacture called the Shahed 136 to the Russian armed forces, which Russia has used over and over again to bombard Ukrainian energy infrastructure across the country with. The Iranians have also shared how to build these drones with the Russians, and so Russia is now known to be manufacturing hundreds of them on their own. While Iran is even further known to have plans to build a new factory producing Shahed 136s within Russia itself, which will boost Russia's production and supply of Iranian-made drones in Ukraine and Europe even further. And if that wasn't enough, the European Union just revealed in early September of 2024 that they have credible evidence that Iran has provided at least 400 short-range ballistic missiles to the Russian armed forces since the Ukraine invasion began as well. And Iran is far from the only one doing so. Ever since North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un stepped across the border and visited Russia a year ago in September of 2023, the Hermit Kingdom is believed to have transported at least 11,000 containers full of arms on trains bound for the Russian armed forces' use on the front line in Ukraine, which, according to the South Korean Defense Ministry, has included as many as 5 million rounds of artillery destined for the barrels of Russian guns and a number of their Hwasong-11 class short-range ballistic missiles. Missiles which have already been identified to have struck Ukrainian cities and caused dozens of Ukrainian deaths. And above all, no other country has assisted the Russian war machine in Ukraine more than China has, which has provided the Russians with a vital economic lifeline by continuing to buy up Russian oil and natural gas, and by continuing to send them high volumes of what are so-called dual-use products. Things like semiconductors, machine tools, jet engines, and spare parts that can be used for both civilian and military applications that Russia has been using to continue building out things like guided missiles and munitions for use in Ukraine. Since the invasion began, it's been estimated by the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C., that around 90% of the semiconductors that Russia has imported have all only come from China. Well, according to another report from the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank, Russian imports of Western technology like microchips have already returned back to their pre-war levels, largely facilitated through China, a fact that led the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, to declare in April of 2023 that when it comes to Russia's defense industrial base, the primary contributor in this moment is China. With the U.S. so heavily backing the Ukrainian side in the war with more than $175 billion in approved aid since the invasion began in 2022, it can't be helped but to see the Ukraine conflict through the lens of it being the first major proxy war of the 21st century between the two global superpowers, America and China. But the high level of cooperation that's presently going on the battlefield in Ukraine between Russia and China and Iran and North Korea, too, is increasingly extending well beyond throughout the rest of Eurasia as well. In early 2022, merely days before Russia invaded Ukraine, China and Russia each signed a joint manifesto that declared a no-limits partnership between them, that also called for a new, multipolar world order no longer dominated by the hegemony of the United States. Then, in addition to supporting Russia with diplomacy and supplies for the war in Ukraine, China sent around 100 of their troops to carry out 11 days worth of joint military exercises with Belarus just a few months ago in 2024 that took place only a few kilometers away from the border with Poland, a NATO member state which also represented the first time in history that Chinese soldiers have ever deployed to Europe. The Chinese, Russian, and Iranian navies have all held joint naval exercises in the Gulf of Oman for the past 3 years in a row now, most recently in March of 2024. While in August of 2023, the Chinese and Russian navies even hosted a joint naval exercise nearby to Alaska, and Russia has already proposed further joint naval drills with China and North Korea. In June of 2024, Russia and North Korea made history by signing into ink a brand new mutual defense pact. The first of its kind since the Cold War era that now legally binds Russia and North Korea together to support each other militarily if either one of them comes under attack. Russia and Iran appear imminently on the brink of signing their own new strategic partnership agreement soon. And after the U.S. government gave the Ukrainians the green light to begin using American-made weapons on Russian territory, U.S. intelligence agencies began warning that Russia was considering to retaliate by providing advanced anti-ship missiles to the Houthis in Yemen. an Iranian-backed proxy that's been attacking merchant shipping in the Red Sea linked to Israel, America, and Britain since last year, showing evidence that Russia is beginning to support Iran's interests in the Middle East more directly as well. All have increasingly become members of the same international blocs as well, with Iran formally joining the BRICS grouping in 2024, Iran signing a new free trade agreement with the Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union in December of 2023, and Iran's joining of the China and Russia-led Shanghai Cooperation Organization just a few months before that, in July of 2023. All of this recent cooperation and alliance structures emerging between these four Eurasian powers has led to several commentators and analysts in the Western world to begin referring to them as some kind of new axis. A group of four nations currently dissatisfied with the US-led global order collectively pushing back against American influence worldwide, that is growing more and more cohesive and united, that has variously been called by some as the axis of upheaval or the axis of disorder. But in order to really understand why all four of these countries suddenly seem to be collectively working together against the Western world order, what each of their goals are, what they all have in common, and how they're able to help each other, and what could end up eventually tearing them all apart and ruining their budding alliance building, it's important to first understand what each of their individual goals are, how the US became all of their common enemy, and how their relative strengths and weaknesses all complement one another. You see, all four of these powers maintain revisionist geopolitical objectives that the current world order, dominated by the United States and friends, will simply not tolerate. Russia is currently trying to conquer Ukraine and has already invaded and occupied roughly 20% of Georgia's territory as well, as the Kremlin seeks to establish its dominance across the territory of the former Soviet Union. China has been open about its desire to establish a firm control over Taiwan, by force if necessary, while Iran has, for decades, been open about its desire to destroy the State of Israel from existence, and to topple the various pro-Western monarchist regimes in the Muslim world like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Jordan. While North Korea has never given up on its ultimate ambition to one day unify the Korean Peninsula under its control, that would necessitate the destruction of South Korea. The US is seen by all four of these powers as the ultimate protector of states or regimes that they would like to see destroyed, like Ukraine, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, and South Korea. Through its own overwhelming military power and bases all around the world, and through its formal alliance structures like NATO, and America's treaty allies in the Pacific like Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, and New Zealand, America has been able to effectively contain the ambitions of all four of these states for decades now. And so, all four of them have an interest in rolling back American influence in each of their respective theaters, and all four view the United States as their primary enemy for the moment, standing in the way of their goals. Meaning that each essentially views each other right now by the old axiom, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." And to an extent, they're all being forced to collaborate together because of US financial sanctions and trade restrictions that have been imposed against them, eliminating their abilities to trade or conduct business with the Western world. Iran and North Korea have both been suffocated under heavy American sanctions and trade restrictions for a very long time, owing to North Korea's successful nuclear weapons program and ICBM tests, and Iran's attempted nuclear weapons program and its support of proxy and terror forces across the Middle East. These sanctions have prevented both countries from acquiring modern Western technology and have left their military forces languishing with long outdated equipment, with the North Korean Air Force still entirely made up of old Soviet-era aircraft, and the Iranians still flying the ancient American aircraft from the 1960s and 70s that were provided back when Iran was still ruled by the pro-Western Shah. The rivals in South Korea and Israel are substantially better armed and militarily capable than they are with the latest American and Western equipment, which is why they've resorted to acquiring nuclear weapons and investing in unconventional warfare instead, like Iran's network of proxy forces throughout the Middle East. They also each have had chronic shortages of raw materials and other resources due to decades of Western sanctions. Iran has suffered from chronic shortages of computer chips and plastics and cars that has devastated their manufacturing sector, while North Korea has suffered from rampant shortages of fuel, food, and technology as well. And they've dealt with an economy that's even more crippled than Iran's has been because, unlike Iran, North Korea just doesn't have massive amounts of oil that they can still sell to some people abroad. With their limited resources and technology and their geographic separation, Iran and North Korea were not really able to effectively collaborate or work together on very much until fairly recently, and each was, and still remains, highly dependent on China just in order to survive. With Iran's ability to sell its oil to most of the world crippled by targeted Western sanctions, Iran has had no other choice but to sell a whopping 90% of all of their oil exports exclusively to China, and at a steep discount of up to 15% off the global market price, since China is in the position to drive a hard bargain as one of the only countries in the world actually willing to do business with them. And despite the overwhelming reliance of Iran on China as a customer, China is hardly reliant on Iran at all as a provider, since only about 10% of China's oil imports currently come from Iran, even after Chinese purchases of Iranian oil have more than tripled just since 2020. Because Chinese companies are usually pretty risk-averse and don't want to run afoul of American sanctions, overall Chinese trade with Iran has been very low in relation to Iran's size. Across the whole of 2023, China and Iran's total trade volume was valued at a mere $14.6 billion. Barely a blip in the grand scheme of things that represents only 0.2% of China's total worldwide trade. And China's relationship with North Korea, for decades, has been similarly one-sided. In 2022, a whopping 98% of all of North Korea's imports exclusively came from China, while another 53% of all of North Korea's exports also went to China, while the total trade between them was only valued at just $2.3 billion, making Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter equivalent to nearly 20 years worth of Chinese-North Korean trade volume, to put it in a perspective. China's only interest in North Korea, really, is as keeping it just stable enough to survive as a valuable buffer state between itself and the US military and allies in South Korea. And even though China and North Korea have each maintained a mutual defense pact of their own for decades now, China has long been agitated by North Korea's nuclear weapons program and belligerence on the Korean Peninsula, which Beijing views as destabilizing actions that only encourage South Korea and Japan and others to move closer towards the United States. As a result, none of these four states were really particularly close with one another, yet alone allies in the post-Cold War world until very recently, when everything suddenly began to change after Russia invaded Ukraine for the first time in 2014 and seized Crimea, and started coming under limited Western sanctions. And after the US backed out of the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and reimposed a full trade embargo on Iran in 2020. And especially after the Russians launched their full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years later and crossed their own Rubicon in the process, irreversibly scorching their relationship with the Western world and turning Russia into the same kind of anti-Western pariah state like Iran and North Korea had already been for decades. Russia was immediately buried beneath the full weight of US and Western sanctions and trade restrictions, which severely curtailed Russia's ability to trade and conduct business with the Western world, which forced it to quickly begin searching for alternative trading partners in order to try and create some kind of alternative economic order. And due to the sanctions and trade restrictions imposed upon them by the West, and due to Ukraine's resistance and the Western world's military support of them being significantly stronger than they anticipated, Russia quickly began encountering shortages of their own in technological components like computer chips and in munitions and equipment vital for continuing to fight that they could no longer fill by trade with the West. Russia needed to pivot somewhere fast. And the fastest way they could do so was by pivoting hard to the two most anti-Western countries out there that had already been locked out of the Western world's economic order for the longest amount of time, who each simply had nothing left to lose by improving their relations with post-Ukraine invasion Russia. Iran and Russia have been able to since complement each other's objectives and push back against the US-led order in various different ways ever since. Iran has sent thousands of explosive kamikaze drones and hundreds of ballistic missiles to Russia that they've used to bombard Ukrainian cities and infrastructure with, while Russia has likely sent advanced air defense systems and more capable modern fighter jets and helicopters to Iran that the Iranians will use to better safeguard their airspace and critical nuclear weapons research sites from the superior air power of their enemies like Israel, the Gulf states, and the United States. U.S. intelligence agencies reporting fears a few months ago that the Russians were considering arming the Houthis in Yemen with advanced anti-ship missiles for use in the Red Sea is cause for further speculation that the Russians may also be arming Iran's proxy forces across the Middle East as well, potentially extending to Hezbollah in Lebanon as well. A lasting legacy of Iran and Russia's very shared interest in propping up the regime in Syria of Bashar al-Assad, which, since 2015, has seen Iranian and Russian forces fighting on the same side in the country to keep Assad in power, The Russian and Iranian central banks have signed a deal to link their interbank communication systems to try and boost bilateral trade between them. And they've also agreed to conduct trade in their own local currencies in an attempt to put their economic transactions outside of the reach of U.S. enforcement. While Russian investments have also surged in Iran to the point where it became by far the largest source of overseas direct investment in Iran by 2023, taking up two-thirds of all foreign investment in the country for that entire year. And economically, Iran and Russia have recently restarted negotiations to extend and flush out what they call the International North-South Transport Corridor, or INSTC as well, a 7,200-kilometer-long network of freight railways, highways, and maritime shipping routes designed to improve Russian-Iranian bilateral trade and to grant Russian exports like oil and grain a viable export route to increasingly valuable markets in India and China that avoids NATO-controlled choke points like the Turkish Straits. Already, even without the INSTC being completed, the U.S. will struggle to fully stop bilateral Russian and Iranian trade across the landlocked Caspian Sea, over which Iran and Russia are currently able to ship each other weapons with little, if any, U.S. ability to actually stop them, since America has virtually zero influence anywhere around the sea since it's landlocked in the middle of the Eurasian continent. By supporting Russia's war in Ukraine, Iran is able to distract American focus from their own objectives in the Middle East, against Israel and the Gulf states. While at the same time, by supporting Iran and its proxies, Russia is able to conversely distract American forces away from Ukraine, dividing America's attention across two different theaters of operations. Meanwhile, Russia and North Korea have been able to complement each other's needs and wants recently as well. As mentioned previously, North Korea and Russia's new mutual defense pact they signed in June of 2024, pledging each other to the other's military defense during an attack, was a major turning point in their 21st century relations. While North Korea's enormous shipments of artillery shells, ammunition, and missiles to Russia has greatly helped relieve Russia's munitions shortages in Ukraine, while Russia's own domestic arms manufacturing takes time to really get up and running to replace them. In exchange, Russia has begun to provide diplomatic cover for North Korea at the United Nations by utilizing its veto power to shoot down new sanctions. And they've also begun providing North Korea with much-needed fuel and food to help them circumvent already existing sanctions and to stabilize their flailing economy. While perhaps most importantly, the Russians have also likely begun to assist the North Korean military by helping them acquire more advanced technologies. In November of 2023, North Korea managed to successfully launch its first ever domestically produced spy satellite into orbit. And then, just a few months later, in May of 2024, they attempted to launch another satellite into orbit with rocket engines that were powered by low-oxygen kerosene propellant, which is a technology that's known to be common in Russian satellite launches, but that had never been seen in North Korean launches before that point. It appears clear that Russia is now assisting North Korea with its satellite program and, by extension, with its rocket and ICBM programs as well. Most alarmingly, in June of 2024, North Korea tested a missile with multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, or MIRVs, for the very first time, a technology that has long been in use in Russian missiles that essentially arms them with several miniaturized nuclear warheads that can independently target multiple locations from the same missile, which is incredibly challenging for missile defense systems to fully stop and intercept. Even further, recent satellite photos captured by Airbus over Pyongyang's international airport appear to indicate Russian assistance with building out an airborne early warning system for the North Korean Air Force to use as well, which would enable North Korean commanders to direct and coordinate air and missile strikes, including nuclear strikes, from the air. And it'll also greatly enhance North Korea's detection and radar capabilities in tandem with their new satellites, which all means that the North Korean military's capabilities to inflict costs and pain on their enemies during a conflict are beginning to rapidly increase thanks to the proliferation of Russian military technology that they're currently receiving. However, it's also important to understand that out of the four potential members that are often talked about in this hypothetical axis, it is Russia who is the primary one incentivized in building it. And it's so far primarily just an emerging alliance between them, North Korea, and Iran, with a much, much more hesitant China still largely sitting out on the sidelines that'll determine the course of the entire relationship going forward. Whether it evolves further into a true alliance or axis, or whether it slowly just begins to erode away. You see, whereas Russia, Iran, and North Korea have all firmly become pariah states to the United States and its Western allies in their version of the global order, China has still yet to actually double down and take their same kind of a leap. And that's largely simply due to raw economics and the fact that China benefits from the current Western-dominated order far more than Russia, Iran, or North Korea do. Even though Chinese trade with Russia has increased dramatically since the Ukraine invasion to reach an all-time high of $240 billion for the year in 2023, China's trade relationship with Russia still only represents a puny 4% of their overall worldwide trade, while Russia's trade relationship with China now represents a significant 33% of their own worldwide trade. Even China's trade with Russia, Iran, and North Korea all combined is still absolutely dwarfed by China's trade with the United States at $660 billion, and with the EU at nearly another $800 billion more. Meaning that China's trade value with the US and EU is still a whopping 6 times higher than it is with Russia, Iran, and North Korea combined. This makes China much, much more heavily invested in the current world order and Western trade relationships than Russia, Iran, or North Korea are, who have all basically been forcefully severed from the Western economic order and forced into working together with no other alternative. China still has options for now, and while it has begun preparing itself for a possible world of economic pain and crippling sanctions in the future, if the situation over Taiwan eventually evolves into a full-blown crisis, that Rubicon of Beijing's hasn't yet been crossed, and until it does, China will balance itself between the lucrative economic relationship with the West and the lucrative geopolitical relationship with Russia, Iran, and North Korea. And China will likely only fully commit to the others if and when they eventually decide to double down on an invasion of Taiwan that will finally turn them into another anti-Western pariah state with little other alternative. This all ultimately means that the evolving relationship between Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, at least for now, remains far from an actual alliance of states resembling something like NATO. They share some unified goals, like rolling back American influence around the world, but they also have many divergences, opposed interests, and mutual suspicions that will prevent them from ever truly committing all the way towards a more formal alliance. And it mostly all revolves around China. China's unequal relationships with all of them, and China's unwillingness to actually fully commit to any of them. After all, as it stands now, the only solid alliance agreements between any of them are between Russia and North Korea, and between China and North Korea, but not between Russia and China, while Iran doesn't have any such firm alliance agreements with any of them. Let's start by outlining the difficulties in the China-Russia relationship, which is arguably the strongest bond between any of the four, and still very problematic anyway. China is, effectively, satisfied with the current status quo in their relationship with Russia, especially since whatever outcome ultimately happens in Ukraine, China will stand to benefit. This is because, on the one hand, the longer the war in Ukraine drags on for, the weaker it'll keep making Russia due to continued losses in troops and equipment and continuing worsening relations with the West. And so, the more and more dependent Russia will come to grow on China just in order to survive. Already, the explosion in trade between China and Russia since the Ukraine war broke out has largely only served Chinese interests at the expense of the Russians. After Western companies began fleeing Russia en masse after 2022, Chinese companies flooded into the void to replace them and began crowding out Russia's own domestic industries, with a notable example being Russia's auto industry. Between 2022 and 2023, China's share of the new car market in Russia doubled from about 30% to 60% of the total nationwide market, which has since transformed Russia into the world's largest importer of Chinese cars, and crowded out Russia's own domestic car industry in the process that can't compete with China while placed under such heavy and restrictive sanctions by the West. Moreover, in addition to China coming to dominate countless markets in Russia from automobiles to computer chips to machine tools, the Russians have also come to rely extremely heavily on China as a customer for their own raw materials, like oil and gas. Just like Iran, because practically nobody else will buy from them, which has only given China even more leverage to squeeze Russia out on prices. After the Western world began banning imports of Russian oil and gas, Russia began pivoting its energy supplies to Asian countries like China and India. And Russian oil exports to China consequently surged by 24% between 2022 and 2023, to the point where about 45% of all of Russia's oil exports were traveling to China, roughly the same ratio that had been traveling to Europe before the Ukraine invasion began. This suddenly transformed Russia into the number one largest supplier of oil to China, with Russian imports taking up roughly 19% of China's total oil imports as of 2023, a ratio that's unlikely to climb up any higher, since China maintains an informal policy of restricting any one supplier of resources to no more than 20% of their total, in order to maintain a diversity of supply. And since Russia, and Iran as well for that matter, can't sell their oil to many other countries besides China, China is able to play hardball on the price and has been able to negotiate their supplies at about a $15 to $30 discount a barrel from them off the global market price, which China is then able to process into cheap refined fuel and petrochemicals and sell abroad for a tidy profit, enabling China to gain oil for cheap while Russia and Iran gain at least some kind of economic lifeline to keep them afloat. But it's not just oil that Russia has been forced to sell to China for much cheaper than what they used to get from Europe. It's also natural gas. Russia already has one major natural gas pipeline called the Power of Siberia pipeline that links large fields in the Far East directly to China. But it doesn't export very much. In 2020, it only exported 10 billion cubic meters of gas to China throughout the whole year. And since the Ukraine invasion began, they've only managed to increase that total to about 38 billion cubic meters a year that's expected by 2025. While another extension they have planned on the pipeline is expected to add another 10 billion cubic meters a year by 2029. However, that's only a fraction of the amount of natural gas that Russia used to sell to Europe before the Ukraine invasion, which in 2021 stood at a total of about 180 billion cubic meters throughout the year, nearly five times more than what it's currently managing to export to China. With no other pipelines connecting Russia's massive gas fields in Siberia to anywhere else other than Europe, and with Western sanctions ensnaring the country's LNG projects in the Arctic by restricting their access to funding and crucial technology, Russia's only available options to get more gas to new markets like China is by either building out new pipelines or by developing their own liquefied natural gas business without the help of the West, neither of which are good options. For many years, Russia has been trying to build out the proposed Power of Siberia 2 pipeline to China from the Siberian gas fields that used to supply Europe, which, if ever finished, would be able to transport another 50 billion cubic meters worth of gas to China a year. But negotiations on building it have been stalled with China for years, as, once again, China knows that it has the leverage to play hardball with Russia on pricing terms for the project and can demand rock-bottom prices since Russia has no other possible customer to sell the gas to. China's government, right now, is probably simply waiting until huge new LNG supplies of gas enter onto the world market from the United States and Qatar in 2025 and 2026, before then demanding horrible terms on the Russians for the pipeline. And if Russia continues to be weakened by the war in Ukraine until then, they will have little other choice but to accept China's harsh terms on the project. As the war in Ukraine continues dragging on, Russia will be forced to continue giving up more and more of its natural resources to China at bargain bin prices, while China will continue dominating more and more of Russia's own domestic markets too, which is why China is only in a way incentivized to trickle just enough military and economic support to Russia to keep them stable and fighting, but not enough to make them decisively victorious. If Russia wins or loses but just doesn't collapse, China will still come out ahead either way, with a greatly weakened and significantly more dependent Russia that could even begin becoming a de facto Chinese vassal in everything but name. And if that happens, China could begin using its increasing leverage over Russia to demand more and more, especially related to advanced and sensitive Russian military technology. Just as North Korea has already done in exchange for their military support to Russia, China could begin demanding technologies from Russia that they currently lag behind in, like in hypersonic missile tech or in submarine nuclear propulsion tech that they could combine with their own manufacturing prowess to begin challenging the US Navy's supremacy around Taiwan even more than they've been able to do already, And even if the war in Ukraine expands beyond Ukraine's borders into another European country that drags in NATO and the US into an even deeper conflict in Europe, the better for China, since the more focused Washington will get on defending Europe, the fewer resources and attention it'll have to spare to dedicate to a parallel crisis in East Asia evolving around Taiwan, granting China more room for strategic flexibility within their own theater. From Beijing's perspective, the worst thing that could happen would be an immediate ceasefire or peace agreement in Ukraine that ends the fighting and ends Russia's vassalization process. Because, rather than becoming Russia's true ally, China would simply prefer to force Russia into the position of becoming a tributary state, like from the Ming Dynasty era, that opens up all of Russia's natural resources, technology, and arms industry to China for as cheaply as possible, while distracting the US and Europe as much as possible at the same time, which is the true win from Beijing's perspective that the Western world will struggle to ever stop. In order to actually stop the process of Russia falling into becoming China's vassal and to pull them apart from one another, the West will have no other choice but to compromise on Russia's quest for Ukraine. If the West immediately halted all of its support for Ukraine and Ukraine proceeded to implode and quickly fell under Russian subjugation, then Russia would stop its terminal bleeding out and stabilize and would be able to begin resisting a geopolitical takeover by China. But since the West is almost certainly not going to compromise on Ukraine out of fear of encouraging further Russian aggression in other European countries, the process of China and Russia's deepening but highly unequal relationship will probably remain a long-term trend for at least the next few decades, with Russia increasingly struggling to resist China's growing demands as time continues on. This isn't really an alliance. It's a desperate move by a Russia with no other choice and a China that sees a once-in-a-century opportunity to vassalize another major power. China also almost certainly is annoyed by Russia's increasingly close relationship with North Korea, too. China remains worried that Russia's defense pact with North Korea and increased military assistance with them might increase the Kim regime's confidence in aggression, which could permanently alter the regime's risk-making calculus and decision-making. Already just this year, in light of their growing alliance with Russia, North Korea has amended their constitution to declare South Korea as their principal enemy, while Kim even further declared that the eventual peaceful reunification of Korea has now become impossible. These developments have led some well-respected North Korea analysts, like Robert L. Carlin and Siegfried S. Hecker, to declare in an essay written earlier this year that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is more dangerous today than it has ever been at any time since early June of 1950, immediately before North Korea decided to invade South Korea and started the Korean War. They wrote in their essay that they believe Kim Jong-un has already made the strategic decision to go to war with the South, and the only question is when. If they continue rapidly evolving the capabilities of their armed forces with the assistance of the Russians, and they feel like the United States is sufficiently distracted elsewhere by other conflicts around the world and other theaters, might Kim actually calculate, no matter how wrongly, that he could succeed with Russia's backing during an attack? If he did, the distraction to the United States he would cause in Korea would be absolutely gigantic, which would stand to benefit other powers like Russia and Iran, but would absolutely not benefit China whatsoever, who would be loath to see a hot war erupt so nearby to them on the Korean Peninsula that would almost certainly see North Korea's collapse and an uncertain use of the North's nuclear weapons arsenal. China wants to maintain the North as a weak buffer state that keeps the US military in South Korea away from their own borders. And China doesn't want Russia encouraging North Korea to act more aggressively and destabilizing in the region than it already has been. At the same time, however, Russia and North Korea's improving relationship can also be seen as a hedge between them against China. China is only incentivized to keep Russia and North Korea relatively strong, but only just strong enough to where Beijing can exploit their strengths and capabilities against the US and the West, but not strong enough to where they can establish their own center of gravity and break out from being forced into supporting roles. Russia and North Korea both know well enough that being forced into becoming Beijing's tributary states is an unstable position for them to get in the long term. China has routinely weaponized its leverage as North Korea's biggest trading partner to force the Kim regime into conforming to Beijing's interests, while China and Russia have, at best, a complicated history that includes the time when the Soviet Union and China almost went to nuclear war with one another in the late 1960s over a small territorial dispute in the Far East that remains unresolved to this day, with China's most recently released official map still showing that territory under Russian control as rightfully belonging to China, which without a doubt puts deep suspicion of China's long-term intentions in the heart of Russia. By increasing their cooperation, Russia and North Korea can not only improve their deterrence against the United States and the West, but they can also hedge their position against the risk of an increasingly domineering China. And if all of that wasn't enough problems getting in the way of all these countries' cooperation, there's also several issues arising between Russia and Iran's potential for an alliance as well. To start, Russia and Iran have very similar economies, which doesn't make them very natural trading partners. Out of the top 15 biggest imports in both countries, 10 of them are the same. And out of their top 15 biggest exports, 9 of them are also the same, giving them little opportunities to trade with each other outside of military support. Moreover, both countries have recently become intense competitors for the same markets with their oil exports, mainly China. Iran exports 90% of its oil to China, while Russia exports 45% of its oil to China now, which has led to a price war between them that Russia is increasingly winning, since they just produce more oil and their oil isn't subjected to secondary sanctions like Iranian oil is. And with a clear upper hand in this trade, Russia hasn't ever really been heavily incentivized to actually cooperate with Iran, and so Iran's oil exports are getting clobbered and crowded out in China. This makes their potential for collaboration on the INSTC corridor route potentially challenging, as Iran could just end up seeing it as another way for Russia to continue increasing their exports of the same exact goods to China, which will continue just crowding out Iran's market share in China and depriving them of even more cash. And even further, the two countries have recently found themselves at direct odds in the South Caucasus, where Russia recently expressed its support for Azerbaijan's proposed Zangezur corridor. Their idea to set up a self-administered trade corridor through Armenia's southern province of Syunik that would connect the Azerbaijani mainland with their disconnected exclave of Nakhchivan. Azerbaijan has attempted to negotiate this exact corridor with Armenia for years now. But, as diplomacy has continually gone nowhere, Azerbaijan has routinely threatened that it could use force to establish it if necessary through another war. A future war that could end up seeing Azerbaijani forces invading and occupying some or all of Armenia's southern and remote Syunik province. Iran would never tolerate seeing this happen, though, because such a development would permanently block them from access to the Caucasus by land and also block off their access to Russia and Europe by land. Which is why, historically, Iran has supported Armenia against Azerbaijan and Turkey. Russia also used to more heavily support Armenia, with Armenia even being a member of Russia's CSTO military alliance. But after Azerbaijan began attacking Armenian territory and interests in 2023, and Armenia attempted to call Russia in to defend them, Russia, bogged down in Ukraine, simply refused to do so, which has since led Armenia to indefinitely freeze its participation in the CSTO and its prime minister to even declare that Armenia will soon be withdrawing from the alliance altogether, which has really pissed off Russia and led to the Russians steadily shifting more and more of their support to Azerbaijan instead. Especially since Russia has proposed the INSTC route as going through Azerbaijan to Iran instead of through Georgia and Armenia. After Russia suggested that they would support Azerbaijan's desire for the Zangezur corridor through southern Armenia, Iranian diplomats took the unusual step of blasting Russia online, with the new Iranian foreign minister, Saeed Abbas Araghchi, even accusing Russia of crossing one of Iran's red lines in the region on X, showing that despite appearances and cooperation in other theaters, Iran and Russia continue to maintain significant and potentially dangerous differences in others. All four of the powers involved in this supposed axis of upheaval, if you can even call it that, are indeed incentivized to encourage and prolong conflicts in each other's theaters as a way of distracting the United States from their own goals in their own theater of operations. Russia is incentivized to prolong the war raging in the Middle East in order to distract from Ukraine, while Iran and North Korea are incentivized in prolonging the war in Ukraine to distract from the Middle East and the Korean Peninsula. While Russia, Iran, and North Korea would all be incentivized to support China in the event of a conflict eventually blowing up over Taiwan. By cooperating together, they can all put pressure on the United States across the world, who cannot simultaneously support every single country it champions against them at the same time, ranging from Ukraine to Israel to Taiwan to South Korea. These four countries all know that they cannot defeat the United States and its allies militarily in a one-on-one conventional fight. But by constantly harrying the United States in each of their respective theaters and keeping the United States responding everywhere, they hope that they can eventually exhaust and overwhelm the US and its allies slowly over time. So far, though, Russia and Iran are the only two out of the four that have really doubled down on their ambitions by launching wars across their respective theaters. But all four would, in a sense, like to eventually see Russia emerge victorious in Ukraine, because it would prove that the US-led Western order can be successfully challenged and even defeated, which would show once and for all that the era of multipolar world order has arrived after decades of unipolar dominance by the United States since the end of the Cold War. Especially coming on the heels of America's disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021. And this is also the same logic right now that compels the United States to so heavily invest in defending the countries that it champions, like Ukraine and Israel, to show to the rest of the world after Afghanistan that further challenges against its hegemony and world order will not be tolerated in order to discourage more challengers from potentially trying their luck next, such as China against Taiwan, North Korea against South Korea, and even others like Serbia against Kosovo or Venezuela against Guyana. If Russia is successful against Ukraine, or Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran are successful in some way against Israel, it could end up opening up a worldwide can of worms that the United States would be greatly challenged to contain. Russia's attack on Ukraine and Iran and its proxies' attacks on Israel have both been massive gambles that were intended by each of them to avoid the US-led world order from encircling them. And now, Iran and Russia's support for the other in their respective theaters feeds each other's willingness to continue escalating and getting more aggressive. Russia's military and diplomatic support to Iran and its proxies in the Middle East has certainly increased Iran's willingness to engage in more risky bouts of escalation that culminated with Iran's first ever direct attack on Israel in April of 2024. When Iran fired a retaliatory attack against Israel in response to the Israeli bombing of their embassy in Damascus that saw hundreds of Iranian drones and ballistic missiles fired at Israel itself. While there isn't any evidence that Russia in any way supported the Hamas attack against Israel that was launched on October 7th of last year that launched the current war in Gaza, it has no doubt still benefited the Kremlin anyway by heavily distracting the US military to refocus on the Middle East again. It's still not even clear exactly how much influence Iran had over Hamas in their decision-making process when they launched the October 7th attack in the first place. But it's clear that the attack greatly benefited Iran nonetheless. Had Saudi Arabia agreed to normalize its relations with Israel and entered into a mutual defense pact with the United States, which was what was being negotiated prior to October 7th, it would have established a nearly continuous arc of NATO states and major non-NATO allies aligned to Washington, completely blocking Iran off from access to its proxies in the West like Hezbollah and the Houthis. After Hamas attacked Israel and goaded the Israelis into a massive, oversized retaliation in Gaza, the Saudis knew that they could never negotiate a normalization agreement with Israel as tens of thousands of Palestinians were actively dying. And so the deal and Iran's potential encirclement have both been frozen ever since. The October 7th attack itself was historically significant for multiple reasons. Not least because it represented the most significant armed attack against Israel in the past half a century since the 1973 Yom Kippur War. And it saw around 7,000 combatants in Gaza organized by Hamas invade and attack Israeli territory. The destruction caused by their attack into Israel quickly became visible by satellites from space. And after the dust began to settle, it became evident that the attack had killed around 1,100 people in Israel and resulted in the abductions of another 250 more people back into Gaza as Hamas's hostages. It represented the single deadliest attack against the state of Israel in the country's entire history. And it led directly to Israel's massive and arguably genocidal retaliation against Hamas in Gaza that has followed ever since and is continuing to this day. I think it's very important to understand, as clearly as we currently can with presently available information and data, what exactly happened in the surge of violence around Gaza during the 24 hours that passed on October 7th, and the very long context of history that led up to those 24 hours. Because it has all led directly to everything that's currently happening in Gaza and the West Bank that you almost constantly see nearly every day on the news right now. One of the most appalling and tragic humanitarian catastrophes that has ever happened in the 21st century that has led directly to the deaths of tens of thousands. But obviously, if I made a very in-depth video covering the entire course of events that transpired on October 7th, hour by hour, the many, many disturbing, violent, and inherently controversial details of discussing a very recent mass casualty event that has inflamed tensions and passions from all around the world would without a doubt cause the entire video to become demonetized and age-restricted, which I actually agree with and think is very appropriate. But it also ultimately means that YouTube's algorithm, which is designed to show you videos alongside of ads to make money, would never promote the video to you in your feed. Which means that there's just simply no way that you would ever see it here on this site at all. And that's why instead, I created yet another full-length companion video to this one in my ongoing Modern Conflict series that covers, to the best of my ability, the entire course of events and explanation into what happened during those 24 hours on October 7th between Gaza, Hamas, and Israel. And I uploaded it directly to Nebula, where you can go and watch it right now. As I'm sure you've probably already heard by now, Nebula is the home of tons of exclusive ad-free content like my entire Modern Conflict series, with more than 30 other full-length exclusive videos over there that you can go and watch right now, covering dozens of recent major wars and conflicts that'll help you stay up to date on what's going on in our world and why. From this hour-long video covering the entire history of the Israel-Palestinian conflict prior to October 7th to catch you up to speed on the decades of historical context that led up to the attack, to these 6 videos covering the history and progression of the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine, to these videos covering the history of America's wars against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and the International Coalition Against ISIS, and many, many more, with brand new episodes releasing every single month. And even better, I also recently started another completely new monthly series on Nebula called War Room, which will track all of the latest breaking geopolitical news developing from conflicts around the world and break them down into a single, easily digestible monthly video briefing series that'll help you stay even more up to date and informed on what's currently happening around the world and why. The latest episode in War Room covering all of the breaking geopolitical news and developments from last month in August is now live on Nebula for you to go and watch right now. And new episodes will be released every single month, just like the monthly new episodes in Modern Conflicts have been, meaning 2 new exclusive real-life lore videos on Nebula that you won't find on YouTube going out every month going forward. And what's even more, you also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's on Nebula. Because the best part about this site is that it's jointly co-owned by all of its creators, built by me and hundreds of other independent YouTubers and podcasters. And because it's a subscription-based service, we all get to work on way bigger and higher budget productions over there than we could ever do on YouTube. That's why there's tons of other exclusive content that you'll find equally fascinating from all of these other creators over there you probably also already know as well. And best of all, if you sign up by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now, or by scanning the QR code on your screen, or by following the link down below in the description, you'll receive an insane 40% discount off of an annual subscription. Which means it'll only cost you $3 a month or $36 a year for all of this awesome exclusive content from myself and hundreds of other independent creators, with even more stuff getting added every single month. It is the absolute best way to help support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. And as always, thank you so much for watching.